WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Julianne Baird, has been described in the New York Times as one of the most recorded and distinguished sopranos of the early music movement. Classical music critic David Patrick Stearns wrote, "Her voice gives a distinctive incandescence to everything she sings." Baird has performed with many major orchestras, including the New York Philharmonic, the Cleveland Orchestra, and the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. She's also a scholar of early music and has taught at Princeton University and the New England Conservatory of Music. She's now on the faculty of Rutgers University. Her recent recordings have focused on fascinating themes in and beyond early music, such as English songs about madness, music from Jane Austen's songbooks, parlor songs, lullabies, and her latest, a collection of Lieder by Fanny Mendelssohn. Let's start with a song from the Jane Austen songbook. This is Silent Worship by Handel. Julianne Baird, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Now, you specialize in what's described as early music. So what period are we specifically talking about when we use the word early music?
Well, I think these days we talk about anything from Middle Ages through, certainly through Mozart, and of course with people like Roger Norrington and recordings of Beethoven and Berlioz. It's been extended with Brahms all the way through the Romantic era, and that we generally call historically informed performances or performances on original instruments.
What do you love about that period?
I think what I love the most is the fact that the performer had a voice. Music was regarded as a blueprint, and without the performer's input to bring it alive, it wasn't considered a complete art. And what I experienced in conservatory, and I think a lot of my colleagues did too, is that there was a kind of a holy attitude about music that one must totally prostrate oneself to, and that individual input was not valued. And of course, in Baroque music, without it, you're not really performing it correctly. So I think it reflects my desire to put my two cents in.
Are there differences in singing early music, technically? What a singer's expected to do, the quality of voice he or she is expected to have compared to more contemporary classical singing?
Well, certainly you need to have a lighter voice, I think, in general, than what we think of as the kind of voice that would cover, that would be strong enough to fill the Metropolitan Opera. Because there you need, volume is probably the first criterion. It's most important to be loud. Maybe beauty is also important, but maybe not even as important as how loud you can sing. And to be an early music singer, to be able to get around those fast passages, you have to have a certain amount of flexibility. So an easy kind of production that allows for a lot of agility. It can't be too quiet. We know that styles of music changed. For example, certain ornaments that they did in Monteverdi's era, which were in a small room and easily able to be heard did not work in a 500-seat opera house. Even when they moved to houses that only had 500 seats, the styles changed to a certain extent. So we get in some of the books on singing, them making fun of singers who were still doing what they called chicken cackling. Namely, something that sound, they said that it was the sound that a chicken made after laying an egg. But that same style was exactly what you wanted in 1600, whereas in 1700 it was truly a laughable thing.
Could you demonstrate that chicken cackling?
They were talking about a kind of light, we might call it a sort of a giggle against the soft palate, which books call the trillo, sort of ha 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 ha. It's kind of a quick motion of the glottis. And, of course, that's not an ornament that's going to carry in a big room. And so they began to make a lot of fun of that, and they wanted a more, I'd say, projected sound, probably. They even talk about differences in the way the articulation should be done, so that whereas a very distinct articulation might have a lot of vowels said on each note, ha 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 ha, by the time we get to the middle Baroque, they're not wanting that anymore. They want one articulation follow through. Ah, if that helps to describe a little bit.
Let's talk about vibrato. Do you use a different kind of vibrato or any more or less of it when you're singing early music than when you're singing more contemporary art song?
Well, I'd have to say yes. For one thing, in the instrumental treatises, we learned that vibrato was to be used sparingly. And they tell you specifically, it's not until 1750 or so that we get a book on violin playing that says you should make vibrato all the time. And even in Brahms' violin concerto, there are places where Joachim, it was marked that he made the vibrato. So this concept of vibrato all the time even wasn't the case in the 19th century in the Romantic era, which is kind of fascinating for people. But in singing, and particularly in singing early music, there are written-out ornaments that we know were specifically for vibrato. I showed you the trillo, which is that kind of throat articulation. There was another kind of trillo for Monteverdi's era that involved more diaphragmatic articulation, and in a way, a kind of quote-unquote vibrato. Maybe like, if I can demonstrate it, sort of like this. Ah, see. If you will, what I'm doing is just kind of contracting my stomach muscles to make a sort of intensity vibrato. And they would use that kind of technique on a word like tears or suffering or crying, weeping. And so that's a specific kind of a vibrato that gets used in certain situations. Even by the time we get to Bach, he writes out a vibrato. He calls it a Bebung. And it looks kind of like a wavy line that goes on and on. And he recommends, for example, in the St. John Passion, that that's the kind of ornament that is used on the word death. So it's interesting. There are specific ways of writing vibrato. And also it was used in Purcell to indicate cold, sort of fear and cold. So they actually used it.
So is it like a dramatic underscore?
Mm-hmm. Very much. So if you're using, it's really hard if you're vibrating all the time to make that a special effect, you see.
Now, I want to play another song from one of your records, and this is a CD entirely given over to what you describe as English mad songs and airs. And these are all songs about madness and depression and suicide. Mm-hmm. And this is a song by Purcell. Are you doing any of the things that you talked about in the song?
Yes, a lot of note bending, if you will, a lot of sliding between notes. That's another thing we think of as kind of a later phenomenon, but they had this strange kind of glide and slide, and the whole point was to proceed from one note to another imperceptibly, so you didn't really realize when you got from one to the other. So it's kind of this real slow slide.
Well, this song is called With Sick and Famished Eyes. Would you just recite the lyric for us?
Sure. With sick and famished eyes, with doubling knees and weary bones, to thee my cries, to thee my groans, to thee my sighs, my tears ascend. No end? My throat, my soul is hoarse. My heart is withered like a ground which thou dost curse. My thoughts turn round and make me giddy. Lord, Lord, I fall, yet call.
And this is Julianne Baird. That's Julianne Baird with Colin Tilney at the harpsichord from Julianne Baird's album English Mad Songs and Airs. Julianne, how come you did a whole album of songs about madness? They're really interesting songs.
Well, I think it had to do mostly with loving Purcell so much, mm-hmm. and also the realization that it was a fascinating time in English history, because the insane asylums for the first time were open to the public for a penny. You could go through the insane asylums and look at the most strange cases of madness. And instead of going to the zoo, that's what the English did during this time. So their diaries full of descriptions of what the insane asylums were like, especially Bedlam, which was Bethlehem, was one of the most notorious of those. And the prisoners slept on straw and naked. But most interesting is the fact that women were locked up at a rate three times to what men were. And they judged the kind of inmate duty that they had to do by the degree of their insanity. So the melancholy ironed, and those that were really violent had to do the heavy washing, you know, the sort of grasping of the fabric and moving it around. And so it's just a fascinating era.
Was there an actual genre called mad songs?
Yes, yes.
And who wrote them? Just the composers of the day, or these people who had themselves been institutionalized at some point?
Well, Jonathan Swift became very fascinated with the whole idea because he was institutionalized in such a place. But Purcell and Blow and other composers of that time wrote
mad songs.
We're
talking the 17th century.
17th century. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very interesting. And did you find that the music was colored by the melancholy of the lyrics?
Yes, in fact, their word melancholy, they used for our word depression.
Right.
And so they had the different states of madness depicted. Sometimes in one song you'd have four or five different kinds of madness. So they really loved going from these variety of states. It meant that the pieces often are very sectional, very short sections, all kind of glued together. So you get mirthfully mad and melancholy madness and stark madness and et cetera.
Were these pop songs of their day?
In as much as they were performed probably in a court setting, they were probably performed for people that were rather privileged. I don't think the hoi polloi probably heard these so very much. We know that the you had to have a little bit of money to go through the insane asylum, and it had become kind of the idle pastimes of the rich to go to the insane asylum. So I think it probably reflected what they were seeing and hearing more than the common people.
My guest is soprano Julianne Baird. Her latest CD is Lieder by Fanny Mendelssohn. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is soprano Julianne Baird. There was a period in your career when you described yourself as a musicologist who sings.
Yes.
I'm not sure you still describe yourself that way. You're a kind of acclaimed enough singer that you are a singer who's a musicologist, I think.
That's right, I think.
But why did you shift the balance toward musicology earlier in your career?
Well, to tell you the truth, part of it was that I didn't trust that I could become a singer.
Mm-hmm.
And I had plenty of indication. It wasn't that I was being told, you're going to be a singer, just be a singer. And it was also my own cautiousness and needing to have a good day job, as it were. And I came from an academic family where that was a natural course of behavior, you know, studying and going to libraries kind of thing. And to tell you the truth, in the discipline that I chose, it's valuable because you need to do a certain amount of your own research and finding pieces. For example, that piece, The Sick and Famished Eyes, doesn't exist in any regular songbook for singers. You have to go digging to find that piece.
No, I believe that you started singing by singing shape note singing. And why don't you describe what shape note singing is?
Well, my family of origin lived in Appalachia. Still, my grandfather's still alive and still living on the old family homestead. And singing was one of the things that we did for fun. It was entertainment. And my grandparents were both very much into the Baptist church, and they loved to sing hymns as a pastime. But neither one could read music. So what they do, basically what shape note singing is there are certain shapes to the notes which indicate what pitch they are. And even though these days they're written on a staff, so that me today, I could look at it and say, that's a G. It's written on one line, and it's therefore a G. They didn't know that that was a G. They just knew that it was a certain shape and that that meant to sing that note. So it was interesting. They loved to sing, and they just howled away. It was really very piercing kind of vocal production that goes with that.
How did you find classical singing?
Well, when I was in middle school, my mother suggested that she thought I had a voice and that I should go and sing to the music teachers in school. And before then, I guess it had been commented on in my family that I had a nice voice. But it came to be something that I could do that not that many other people were doing. At least it was a way for me to distinguish myself. And so I sang through high school and applied to several conservatories. Was rejected by some, but then ended up going to the Eastman School of Music, where I immediately changed out of being a voice major.
Why?
Because I felt like I was no dummy. I could tell that what they really wanted was a big vibrato and a huge voice. And I knew I was a square peg and that was never going to fit. And so rather than have them try to tell me, sort of, you're not going to make this work, I said, okay, I'm going to change my major. I'm going to be a musicologist, and then I'll get to sing, and no one can attack me for singing what I want to sing.
Well, it worked.
It did. It actually did.
Well, speaking of not singing with the loudest voice, you have an album of lullabies.
Yes.
And I thought this would be a nice opportunity to hear some soft singing. And this is from a CD called Lullabies, a Songbook Companion, and it's produced by the Metropolitan Museum of Art in conjunction, I guess, with a show that they did.
Well, they decided to publish a book on lullabies, and they wanted to have some of the lullabies demonstrated so that people maybe who didn't read music could buy the record.
Well, this is a familiar lullaby we're going to hear all through the night.
Sleep, my child, and peace attend thee all through the night. Guardian angels, God will send thee all through the night. Soft the drowsy
That's Julianne Baird singing All Through the Night from the CD Lullabies, a songbook companion. That's really lovely.
Oh, thank you.
Did you sing lullabies to your children?
Sure.
In a soft voice?
In a soft voice, it's true. And in fact, it's tough being a singer with kids in the sense that they also recognize that that's part of your profession and it's the thing that makes mom go away also. So I think kids, children of singers, probably have a, I don't want to say a love-hate relationship, but they recognize that there's it's two-sided. You know, mom sings, she sings to you, but she also goes away to sing.
Julianne Baird, it's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you so much.
Julianne Baird's latest CD is Leader by Fanny Mendelssohn. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.